Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome back to Ruination, the early years. I'm King, and as always, I'm joined by my expert guide through the marvelous chaos of Big Fatty Online.
I'm Gail. And we are really diving into a foundational week for BFO here.
We are. We're covering episodes 32 through 36, which is the week of March 17th to the 21st, 2008.
Right. St. Patrick's Day week. Spring is officially starting. But for Big Fatty, it's this incredible balancing act. It's just chaos.
So the mission for this deep dive, really, is to try and pull apart the structural elements of his world.
Exactly. We need to see how he juggles his, you know, his day-to-day domestic life with these intense pop culture obsessions.
And critically, how he starts laying the literal groundwork for what's going to become this huge summer community event.
The podcast palooza.
The palooza.
It's fascinating because he's just come off one major content pillar, the cruise, right?
Yeah.
And he immediately pivots. He's already structuring the next big thing, which is the Orlando trip.
But the small things are what make it so compelling.
That's it. It's how those huge travel plans are set right next to the, you know, the daily rituals, the minor annoyances at home.
The profound trivialities.
That's the perfect phrase for it. That's what cements the audience's bond with him. It's a study in, well, in structural inconsistency.
How so?
He has this rigid daily show format he sticks to, but the content itself is just completely wild and unpredictable.
Okay, so let's start with the overall vibe of the week. You'd think, coming back from a cruise right into St. Patty's Day,
you'd expect a big party weekend.
Right. But in episode 32, he describes his weekend as a gown weekend.
Yes. And that term itself is just, it's instant BFO vocabulary, isn't it? He calls it the sloth weekend.
Defined as what, exactly?
Defined specifically as sitting around his house in his gown all weekend and doing absolutely nothing, except recording the show, of course.
He even had plans, didn't he?
He did. He had plans to go out with his horror friends for beverages on Saturday night, but those plans get canceled decisively.
And the reason is, it's classic Big Fatty hyperbole.
Oh, it's perfect. He cancels because of severe and scurry weather.
Scurry.
He chose the safety of his own home over going out and socializing.
And he's proud of it.
Absolutely. He says he went to bed at 10 p.m. on Friday and Saturday. He really emphasizes how much he enjoys this state of complete sloth.
Which is such a critical point for understanding the whole show, I think.
It is, because despite all the explicit content, the high-energy rants, the demands he makes on his listeners, the persona is anchored in this quiet homebody domesticity.
It's the safe space from which all the chaos can be launched.
Exactly. The quiet foundation. But, you know, that domestic peace gets shattered pretty quickly by the harsh realities of getting older.
The 30-year college reunion letter.
The reunion letter in episode 33. You can just feel him reading it.
It must have felt like a punch in the gut. I mean, 3 decades.
And the event itself is planned at the Embassy Suites Hotel in Charleston. The financial anxiety is just, it's palpable.
It's that, oh, I'm old moment combined with the, oh, this is expensive moment.
$239 a night for the hotel, plus a $150 non-refundable fee just to register.
But the specific thing he latches onto, the logistical gripe that really sets him off,
is that the price is always planned for a couple.
Never for a single person. He sees that as like a structural problem.
It pisses him off, is what he says. Yeah. And it's a perfect example of how BFO takes a minor annoyance and inflates it into this huge complaint about society itself.
And he makes it clear he's not paying that.
Nope. He says he'll be staying at his own apartment, which just highlights the massive gap between his financial situation and what he assumes for his old classmates.
He even says, kind of sarcastically, that many of them are much, much more successful than the fat one is.
And that contrast right there grounds the show. Staying home to save money versus the Embassy Suites crowd. It's relatable financial anxiety.
It's what makes the whole thing work.
It's the BFO grounding mechanism. He connects the high-flying cruise lifestyle and this planned Disney trip to the, you know, the stark reality of booking a hotel room.
And this anxiety about aging, it gets validated immediately by the community, doesn't
Instantly.
It?
Instantly. Super B calls in to commiserate.
Right.
And Super B reveals he just got his AARP information in the mail, and he's only 43 years old.
Wow.
It becomes this moment of, like, collective existential dread. They're defining aging not by wisdom, but by junk mail that confirms their own mortality.
Okay, before we get to pop culture, we have to talk about the household observations from this week. These are more than just stories. They're like BFO's entire philosophy of escalating the trivial.
Starting with the Lynth Green rant.
In episode 33, this is fantastic.
It is. He goes to clean out his dryer's lint screen, and he is genuinely, like, horrified by how much lint is in there.
He finds the sheer volume of it just unbelievable.
And it spirals into this domestic existential crisis.
He starts questioning the structural integrity of his entire wardrobe.
Wondering out loud how his clothes even hold together after shedding that much fiber. He's convinced they must all be threadbare.
It's a formula, really. A minor household chore leads to deep philosophical questions.
The slow, inevitable ruin of all material objects. He just can't make it make sense.
And then we pivot from the structural breakdown of fabric to the pure culinary philosophy of the pork chop.
His love for pork chops is just absolute.
Baked, broiled, fried, and grilled.
But the philosophy, the core of it, is a declaration against, you know, formal dining.
Right. He says definitively that eating a pork chop with a knife and fork is a shame.
You're going to pick them up, eat them right off the bone.
You have to suck on the bone to get the good flavor. It's pure, visceral enjoyment.
It's a rejection of formal structures. It embraces primal pleasure, which is perfectly on brand for him. It's about comfort, honesty, enjoying things the simplest way.
And speaking of interruptions to that simple comfort, this carefully built sloth life gets threatened by breaking news.
The Nip House guest in episode 34.
This is a huge moment for analyzing the whole BFO persona, I think.
It is. A dear friend, who he nicknames the Nip, arrives unexpectedly. He lays out the timeline. The Nip called last night and then just shows up at 4:45 p.m. the next day.
But the really significant detail, the bombshell, really,
is that the Nip had absolutely no idea that Big Fatty even had a podcast.
The two worlds collide.
Yes. You have this private domestic life. The coal mine, the knitting, the pork chops, and then this very public, very explicit online persona.
And his friend, who he says is almost as old as he is, just stumbles into this entire universe of content and memes and listeners.
It raises that central question about being a content creator, you know?
Yeah. Can you really sustain a public life of ruination while keeping your private relationships totally separate from it?
And the answer is clearly no, not forever.
Yeah.
This moment shows that even his closest friends might not really get the scale of what he's building every single day.
He has to reconcile those two identities in real time.
Exactly.
Okay, so while that domestic life is the anchor, the reality TV obsession is, I mean, it's the main engine of the show, isn't it?
It's what generates all the listener feedback, the calls, the long discussions. And this week, it kicks off with a massive soapbox moment for Dancing with the Stars.
He goes all in on DWTS in episode 32. He's begging everyone to watch the new season.
A two-night special on ABC, yeah. And he doesn't shy away from the community's nickname for it.
Dancing with the Tards.
Right. And he says the reason for that nickname comes from the casting of Marley Matlin.
The language is jarring.
It is, but he immediately uses it to highlight this this bizarre logistical challenge of her being on the show. He shares a joke from Superb at the QCast Connection.
Who are his fellow podcasters, part of his network.
Right, his close peers. And Superb's joke is she going to take three steps and reach down and touch the floor to feel the beat?
It's cynical, but it's also expressing this morbid curiosity.
It admits that the sheer absurdity of it makes it mandatory viewing. You have to see how it works.
And the show isn't just entertainment for him. It's a huge cultural event that demands intense consumer participation.
This is where we see his performative consumerism. He's plugging the merchandise.
The DWTS Wii game, the PlayStation versions, the DVDs, the books.
The clothes. But he doesn't stop there. He notes the special offer. Spend $50 at the ABC store and you get a free DWTS journal.
He thinks the whole idea of a DWTS journal is absurd. He says he doesn't know what the F it means, but it's a little book with a cover on it.
Exactly. He's participating in consumer culture. But he's performing the role of the skeptical consumer.
He's mocking it.
He is, but he's also driving his audience toward it because it creates a shared experience. The goal isn't to sell games. It's to make sure he has a community ready to dissect every single sequin.
And by episode 34, he's got his reactions ready. He delivers his critique of the dancers.
And his criteria are so personal. They have nothing to do with technical skill.
He liked Mario and the football player, but his favorite was a total surprise.
Steve Guttenberg. He called him just fantastic. And why? because he felt like Gutenberg was really trying hard and just embracing how absurd the whole thing was.
On the other hand, he hated Penn from Penn and Teller.
Described him as Bigfoot trying to dance because he wasn't taking it seriously enough. And Adam Carolla was horrible because he never looked at his partner.
So it's about effort and connection.
And sincerity.
Yeah.
All filtered through this BFO lens of what makes good entertainment. You have to engage, and he'll forgive the technical flaws if the effort is there.
Moving on to other quiz shows, he notes this this really unusual trend on the Price is Right Million Dollar Spectacular.
He's noticed they've had $2 million winners in just 3 or 4 weeks. He finds it remarkable.
Because they bid so close to the actual price.
Less than $1,000 away. He treats these game show results like breaking financial news. He even notes the last winner got, what, $1,027,062 worth of stuff.
He's analyzing the game show economy.
He is. And of course, Survivor gossip is never far behind.
Right.
He briefly mentions a heinous gay getting thrown off the chat. This isn't from the show itself, but from the fan discussion board.
It's a micro drama.
A tiny drama that shows you how intense these online fandoms are.
Mm-hmm.
But the key thing here is his acknowledgement of spoiler culture.
He thanks Tom the Ramble Redhead for a spoiler website for Big Brother 9.
BB9spoilers.com. And he gives this very serious warning. Do not go there if you hate spoilers, because it tells you everything.
He knows a big part of his audience thrives on being ahead of the story.
He enables them. He provides the resource for the exact behavior he sometimes pretends to be against.
And finally, his moment of intellectual property outrage.
The movie title theft. This is just classic BFO humor. He sees a trailer for a new horror movie called The Ruins.
And he immediately claims it's blatant stealing from Big Fatty Online.
The nerve of a major movie studio using the word ruin.
He clarifies it's not his life story, but the joke itself just elevates his own brand to the level of, like, a Hollywood horror franchise.
It's him claiming ownership of the very concept of ruination.
So community interaction, it's not just a theme, it's the fuel that keeps the whole BFO machine running.
And this week starts with a big problem, a structural problem.
The voice letter drought.
Yeah. In episode 32, he is openly complaining. He says he hasn't had any Thing phone calls in forever on the voice letter line.
He gives out the number 206-337-1438.
He treats the lack of calls as a personal offense.
Mm-hmm.
The audience isn't doing their part.
And he turns that complaint into a direct order in episode 34.
The iPhone B challenge.
Which is brilliant because back then the iPhone was still a new shiny status symbol.
So by demanding that all you B with iPhones call in, he's leveraging technology and status into a requirement for participation.
It's a power move. You have the expensive toy, now use it for my show.
He jokes that he'll have a full voice box, which he loves. He's turning their tech into his content.
The show's structure is also really defined by the bigger network he's a part of, and we get some juicy gossip this week.
Starting with a pregnancy rumor about Holly from We're Mean Because You're Stupid.
He plays a clip from their show where her co-hosts are hinting she's pregnant, joking about her eating for two.
And Big Fatty just jumps all over it. He jokes that Holly is trying to cover up the fact that she may be in sight.
Which is a reference to I Love Lucy.
Right, exactly. He's referencing how they couldn't say the word pregnant on TV back then. It shows this deep knowledge of media history that he applies to modern podcast gossip.
And then he embraces his fatty daddy persona.
Holly, you could make me a very happy grandfather. It's him celebrating these personal changes in his peers' lives and weaving them into his own story.
But while that part of the network is growing, we see other parts starting to look a little fragile.
Yeah, this whole list of changes. It shows how delicate early independent podcasting really was. He's lamenting the end of Riding with Bill.
Bill, the gay construction worker, he's just quitting his show.
And then there's the gay trucker, DJ David J., who is quitting trucking to go back to being a hairdresser.
Which Big Fatty immediately questions.
He questions the whole identity of the show. Will he still be the gay trucker or the gay hairdresser, which Big Fatty calls very redundant?
He's analyzing the structure of the show's brand versus the host's actual life.
And when those things shift, the whole network feels like it could collapse. He even puts out like a missing persons alert for Mike Hipp.
From Podcast Chowder, the guy who sells the soy candles by Phoebes.
He's asking the community for information. The listeners become this interconnected network to keep track of everyone.
And the listener map updates in episode 33 show that community is still growing.
And he's still personalizing the pins. We get that great shout out to Big John from Richlands, Virginia, who is southern fried and ready for the gravy.
He validates other creators too, noting Wes from San Diego's podcast finally made it to iTunes.
Which is a shared victory. And then there's that delightful question from Miss K in South Dakota asking what a sling is.
That's BFO cultural education right there.
The voice letters this week really show that give and take he craves, even when it's hostile.
Eric, the Southern boys call.
He calls in just to tell Big Fatty to suck it for complaining, then later calls back asking for Larry and hangs up. And Big Fatty admits he played the clip just to give Eric content for his own show.
It's meta content sharing.
It is. But I think the most heartwarming part is the practical advice from the listeners.
Hey, John from Virginia, who works for a cell provider.
He calls in to warn Big Fatty about cruise ship cell phone roaming charges, like $2.50 a minute. He's telling him to check his Sprint bill.
The audience is a safety net. They're providing real useful advice based on his own stories.
It shows there's genuine care under all the chaos. And that interdependence is underscored again by Tim from Tampa.
A patron saint.
He calls to say he just lit his very last soy candles by Phoebe, which reinforces this urgent need to find Mike Hibb, the candle seller.
Their physical consumption is tied directly to the network's internal drama.
They need Mike Hibb, not just for gossip, but because they're out of candles.
And the artwork this week is a huge listener contribution.
The Big Fatty Beasley doll. Mm-hmm. Michael from Stuttgart, who Big Fatty lovingly calls fed up, photoshops Big Fatty's face onto a Mrs. Beasley doll.
Which he finds hilarious and immediately makes the show art.
And that's a perfect segue into the next section.
Mm-hmm.
Because it shows the deep cultural literacy of his audience.
Right, and he wraps up the community section by thanking everyone for supporting Auntie Vera Charles's 100th episode.
And he bonds with her over hating daylight savings time. It's those little shared grievances that build community.
So the Memory Lane music segment, it's like Big Fatty's weekly cultural literacy test for his audience.
He's teaching them the deep cuts of his 60s and 70s TV nostalgia. And often, it provides the inspiration for the fan community.
Episode 32, he plays the Doris Day Show theme.
Which is a tribute to Auntie Vera Charles' 100th episode because Vera had actually met Doris Day.
And the trivia he provides is so meticulous.
It's a detailed historical record. A CBS sitcom, 1968 to 1973, 128 episodes. Doris Day plays a widow with two sons who moves to a rural ranch.
He's careful to distinguish the character actor Denver Pyle from Goober Pyle.
He's providing the specific context for a generation of TV that many listeners might not even remember.
Then in episode 33, he plays something really bizarre. The theme from My Mother, the Car.
A truly strange choice, but it's important because it highlights television failure. It only ran for 30 episodes.
Starred Jerry Van Dyke, and the car had a Southern accent.
And the punchline he delivers is that TV Guide named it the second worst show of all time in 2002.
And he asks that perfect question. Who at NBC in 1965 thought this was a good idea?
It shows his fascination with cultural missteps. The spectacular failures that become legendary in their own right. It's a form of historical ruination he's digging up.
And that brings us to Family Affair in episode 34, which is the most important theme this week.
Because it links directly back to that fan art. A listener, Mark, suggested it.
Ran from 66 to 71, bachelor engineer Bill Davis raising his orphaned nieces and nephews.
And the characters, Mr. French the butler, Sissy the teenager, and the six-year-old twins, Buffy and Jody.
And here's the crucial link. Buffy's doll
was Mrs. Beasley.
That's why Michael from Stuttgart chose that doll for the fan art. It's the symbol of 1960s nostalgic innocence.
Being ruined by having Big Fatty's face plastered all over it.
And he immediately turns it into a call to action, asking listeners to call in if they ever own a Mrs. Beasley doll. He even guesses Superb probably had one.
It's the perfect content loop. Obscure trivia inspires fan art, which inspires him to ask for more community interaction based on the original trivia. It's self-generating.
Episode 35 features one of his all-time favorite shows.
The Time Tunnel.
The Irwin Allen sci-fi show.
He loves this genre of high-stakes, structured adventure. He even reads the dramatic narration about the scientists lost in time, tumbling helplessly toward the new fantastic adventure.
Tumbling helplessly toward a new fantastic adventure could be the tagline for Big Fatty Online itself.
It absolutely could. He's the unwilling hero of his own ongoing ruined experiment.
And he ends the segment with an anecdote that brings all that cosmic travel crashing back down to
the Qantas pilot gripe sheets. This section is pure gold.
It's this famous circulated list of real-world absurd humor. He reads the pilot complaints and then the maintenance solutions.
And it shows that no matter how organized a system is, the chaos of the human element will always ruin it.
Let's go through a few of them because they're perfect. He starts with an obvious one.
Gripe. Mousing cockpit.
Solution. Cat installed.
A perfect, literal solution that solves one problem, but immediately creates a dozen new ones.
What about this one? Gripe. Dead flies in coffee machine.
Solution. Cleaned. Simple. Direct.
Then there's this one about structural damage.
Gripe. Number 3, engine missing.
And the solution.
Solution. Engine number 3 found attached to the starboard wing after a brief search. The casualness of a brief search is just perfect.
And the one he saves for last, the ultimate distillation of chaos.
Gripe. Noise sounds like midget pounding with a hammer.
The solution.
Took hammer away from midget.
It's just gold. It's this completely inexplicable structural breakdown and the immediate deadpan fix. It's an analogy for the show itself.
It is. Identify the source of chaos, remove the hammer, and move on.
The Friday segment is always dedicated to the network, and the interview with Tim from Terminally Single is. It's a really deep personal dive that reinforces all of BFO's core themes.
Definitely. Tim is introduced as a 37-year-old, 6'4", tall drink of water from Atlanta, a band geek who played sax.
And he immediately clarifies his show's name because Archer kept calling it Terminally Straight.
Right, and his life in Atlanta is immediately characterized by the same kind of financial struggle Big Fatty was just talking about with the reunion.
He lives with his parents, which he says drives him nuts.
And he's actively looking for a better paying job so he can move out.
Yeah.
This is a successful podcaster, and yet he shares that same fundamental economic anxiety.
BFO uses this segment to normalize those anxieties by finding successful guests who are also struggling with them.
And his domestic stress is then compounded by the chaos of the Atlanta weather.
A recent tornado.
Tim calls it a cluster F, with damage to major landmarks. Big Fatty jokes about him not getting a day off.
And his dating life, which is the whole point of his show, is described as perpetually ruined.
He calls himself a loser magnet. Says he always finds the crazy ones. This kind of self-deprecating analysis of your own romantic failures is core BFO content.
He tells a great story about a trip to New York City with his favorite ex to see 5 shows in one weekend.
And this is where you see the visceral quality of BFO reflected in his guest stories. The highlight was being in the front row for Grey Gardens,
where Christine Ebersole
spit on me when she was singing. And Tim calls it incredible.
Getting spat on by a Broadway star is a badge of honor, a theatrical ruination.
And the lowlight was the complete opposite. Ring of Fire, the Johnny Cash musical, was total crap. He says critics were literally running out of the theater.
Again, that fascination with spectacular failure.
The segment closes with a perfect bit of BFO vocabulary and technical frustration.
Big Fatty confirms Tim is what we refer to in the gay world as gifty and talented.
Referring to his size, which Tim notes did not actually help his podcast downloads. And then he explains his website is terminallysingle.net because some other bee took the .com.
Which is just the perfect summary of the small acts of ruination that came with early podcasting.
It's a great interview. It shows how he uses this segment to pull out these profoundly personal details and reinforce the show's value of radical transparency.
So now we get to the two extremes of content this week. The absolutely unbelievable story that proves reality is stranger than fiction.
And the firm, concrete plan that's going to structure the whole next phase of the show.
Let's start with the bizarre news of the week from episode 33.
From Wichita, Kansas, via the Associated Press. The unforgettable story of the 35-year-old woman stuck on her boyfriend's toilet for 2 years.
It is the epitome of grotesque real-life ruination.
Her skin had grown around the toilet seat. The sheriff confirmed they had to pry the seat off with a pry bar, and it went with her to the hospital.
And Big Fatty immediately zeroes in on the sheriff's name.
Sheriff Brian Whipple.
The Charmin connection.
It adds this extra layer of dark, unbelievable humor to an already unbelievable story.
The details he focuses on are just. They're crucial. The 36-year-old boyfriend fed her every day.
And claimed she didn't want to leave. She kept saying, maybe tomorrow.
It's not just how she got stuck. It's the whole domestic ecosystem that was created around her being stuck.
A boyfriend who just dutifully provides food and water for 2 years. Big Fatty uses this to argue that his own reality show is actually less absurd than real life.
And he quickly pivots to the physical consequences. He's joking about her getting an ad contract from Preparation H.
It's BFO's mastery of the grotesque. Take a horrific situation and immediately jump to the most mundane physical consequence and its commercial exploitation.
It reinforces that real life is often far more ruined than anything he could invent.
It is.
And before the big announcement, we have to touch on the essential anchor of BFO lore.
The skull update.
The skull? the retired coal mine receptionist he hates forever.
She came by the coal mine wearing her Easter sweater. Pale blue, with fuzzy yarn Easter eggs and rabbits on it.
And Big Fatty's reaction.
Succinct. I still hate her. The resentment is eternal. It's a reliable, unchanging source of content.
And finally, the big news of the week. The structural anchor for the entire summer.
The Disney World trip confirmation. The ultimate counterpoint to the sloth and the financial anxiety we started with.
It begins in episode 33 as just a discussion. He and Larry Klaw are thinking about going to Orlando the first weekend in June for gay days at Disney.
And he notes he has to be back before Father's Day.
By episode 35, it's official. The planning is over. The commitment is made.
They're going down Thursday, June 5th, and coming back Monday, June 9th.
And this is not just a vacation.
Not at all. It's a content strategy. It's a logistical commitment to the entire network. He immediately declares it's going to be a podcast palooza.
He's already confirming who's coming. The QCast boys, the Foul Monkeys, Drunky Bill.
The Starbucks guy, Ryan from Terminally Straight. He is actively turning his personal trip into a mandatory, structured network event.
He's requiring the attendance of every major player in his orbit.
And his final call to action to the listeners is just. It's perfect BFO. It's an aggressive, tongue-in-cheek demand for their presence.
He tells everyone to schedule elective dental surgery for June 5th through the 8th so they can be there.
It's an order. Prioritize the podcast palooza over your own physical health, over your job.
The trip is no longer his private vacation.
It belongs to the community now, and it has been weaponized as a content opportunity.
So this dive into Ruination, the early years was. It was dense. We started with the domestic comfort of the sloth weekend.
The existential crisis of the lint screen, the simple joy of a pork chop.
And those domestic anchors are essential, aren't they? They make the extreme content, the two-year toilet story, the demands for iPhone calls. They make it feel relatable.
And earned. The memory lane trivia and the demanding listener participation, they all solidify the show's entire framework.
He's constantly blending the utterly bizarre with the completely grounding. But the real tension this week, I think, is between the Disney commitment and the arrival of the NIP.
Right. He's committing to turning his vacation into this massive public content event, while at the same time realizing his closest friends don't even know this public life exists.
Which raises this core question that his audience has to deal with. He is committing to making every single part of his life content. His friendships, his holidays.
So does making everything content dilute the genuine experience? Does it lead to more ruin in the long run?
Or does the shared mythology, the community that comes together for a podcast palooza, does that ultimately make the experience richer and more valuable than any private trip could ever be?
Is the performance of ruin more valuable than isolated joy? That's what Big Fatty is betting on.
A fascinating thought to end on. Thank you for diving deep with us. I'm King.
And I'm Gail. Tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination.
Yep.
The early years.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, the early years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.